Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger, and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Welcome back to Talking Tudors episode 23. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger. Before we get started, I'd like to thank the wonderful patrons who very generously pledged to support this podcast. A huge thank you to Andy, Joanna, Christina, Sharon, Jenny, Julie, Noel. Thank you Zon, Reluca, Dawn, Daniel, Leslie, Katie, Jenny G, Sarah and Shah. A very big thank you to Beth, Carol, Caroline, Sally, Haynes, Fiona, Stephanie and Stacey. If you love Talking Tudors and would like to show your appreciation and support the work I do, just click on the Be My Patron on Podbean badge on the homepage of my website www.onthetudortrail.com or click on the Be a Patron button on the Podbean app. Join the Talking Tudors patron family before February 28 and you'll be automatically entered into our patron-only monthly giveaways. This month's prize is a $50 gift card to tudorfair.com, home to a range of fabulous Tudor-inspired gifts curated by Heather Tasco from the Renaissance English History podcast. Thank you, Heather, for donating this wonderful gift. Now, on to today's episode. I'm thrilled that joining me on the show to talk about Tudor food and cookery is Brigitte Webster. Brigitte runs the Tudor and 17th Century Experience. She turned her passion for early English history into a business and opened a living history guesthouse where people step back in time and totally immerse themselves in Tudor history by sleeping in Tudor beds and eating and drinking authentic Tudor recipes. She also provides her guests with Tudor entertainment. She loves recreating Tudor food and gardens and researching Tudor furniture. On the day that Brigitte and I chatted, we did experience some slight issues with the internet, which has unfortunately affected the quality of the recording. I apologize in advance for any inconvenience caused. However, the information that Brigitte shared was simply too good not to publish. On that note, my conversation with Brigitte straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sales. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Brigitte. How are you?
Hello. Yes, I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Lovely, lovely. Would you mind introducing yourself to our listeners and telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, of course. Love to. Well, I am Brigitte and I'm married to Tom, a fellow Tudor history fan. And I'm also mum to two grown-up children, Ginny and Philip. But I'm a huge Tudorholic and founder and owner of the Tudor and 17th century experience. My personal interest started about 20 years ago through my research into Tudor furniture and my professional background as a teacher of history and cookery. Now, for me personally, the fascination lies in the changes that took place away from the big events at the royal court. It's more the social history of the Tudor era that is my personal interest.
I agree. That is fascinating. Now, you've mentioned your business. You actually turned your passion for history into a really wonderful and unique business. Could you tell us about this particular business and the Tudor experience that you offer guests?
Okay, yeah. The Tudor experience is basically a living history guest house that offers individuals or even small groups to step back in time and become a Tudor for a day, weekend, or longer if they wish. Visitors that come and stay with us will be guests to the Tudor home of a yeoman farmer. So they get to eat Tudor food, they sleep in Tudor or Elizabethan original bed, and they even get entertained the Tudor way with contemporary music. And sometimes they want to learn Tudor dances and play Tudor games. And other people are interested in the Tudor gardens that I have recreated and want to learn about the herbs, the flowers, the plants.
That's fabulous. Sounds like a wonderful experience.
And then again, we have people who often want to reenact archery skills on a Sunday afternoon.
That sounds like a lot of fun. Sounds really fun. Now, what kinds of food did royalty and the upper classes generally eat?
Right. Now, food in the 16th century did mean a lot more to the individual than it does today. And it made a true statement about yourself and your beliefs. A little bit like vegans today, if you'd like to want a comparison. The food you served and ate signaled your standing in society and also your influence. Mm-hmm. And it was in many ways one of the most powerful tools. And in 1517, sumptuary law fee were passed. So it set out clearly the number of courses that you were allowed to have according to your income. So something like the income of between £40 and £100 was allowed to have up to three. The upper class and the royal circles became also very health conscious in the 16th century, and that reflected very much on the food they wanted to eat. Food that was specifically aimed at royalty and the nobility was, in particular, we need to mention venison. Now, venison you could not purchase on the market, you could not purchase it in the shop. It was something you either had in your park, because you were a part of the nobility, or you could have access to it if you were given it, but you definitely couldn't purchase it. So it was the food that made you stand out from the rest of society. But nobility and the royal circles also ate particular type of fish like sturgeon and salmon, imported goods in particular, because they were very expensive, such as wine from Spain or Italy, exotic and newly discovered food like, for instance, oranges, lemon, also spices like cinnamon and saffron, but also dried fruit as dates, raisins, figs, currants, because all of these had to be imported and that made them automatically very expensive. A royalty and the nobility also started to make young produce in the 16th century. We are talking about young animals here, like veal or lamb, or very young plants, like capers, for instance, which are the buds of a shrub, or rose buds. So very, very young produce. When it comes to bread, obviously everybody had to eat bread, and so did royalty and nobility, but their bread was different. It was of the highest quality. It was called Manchit, and other people couldn't afford it because very time-consuming process to make it, the flour in particular. But generally, the upper-class diet was strongly meat-based, and vegetables only formed a small proportion of their diet and came in pottages and salads. Salad, something that started to become trendy in the 16th century as one of the health foods that was advertised by the physicians. And also, we mustn't forget all the candied food, all the food products, the fruit that came with the use of sugar. Sugar, the big thing of the 16th century, in particular, Robert Dudley actually stands out. His accounts reveal that he purchased comfits, candied fruit, and sucade even before he was granted an earldom by Elizabeth. So those expenditures suggest that he had actually been a leader rather than following food fashion.
Wow.
And also John Dee, for instance, that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. John Dee, we know that he ate at 4 o'clock on the 31st of March 1594 a toasted cake with buttered sugar and nut on it. And I think it's quite extraordinary that with the royal circles and nobility, we often know down to the minute what they ate. Somebody felt it was important to make a recording of it.
Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? How fascinating to know exactly what they ate at that time. So, Brigitte, what were the main ways of preparing food at the time?
Yeah. Right. What's interesting is that the way how the food was prepared depended on your social status, on your station. At the bottom of society, most food was just boiled in one vessel called the cauldron. This was a very efficient vessel where you threw all the ingredients in and you boiled it. At the end of it, you had a lovely pottage, which you ate with some bread and if you had cheese. But in urban environments, people often didn't have a kitchen or anywhere to cook in their home.
Right, okay.
So they had to go and buy ready-made meals from cookery shops, taverns or street sellers, so they didn't cook anything. But what's extraordinary is the upper middling sort of people, so you're talking about to talk a little bit better, their food often was cooked twice. So meat, vegetables were first boiled or parboiled and then fried or roasted. And the food at the top of the line was deliberately labor-intensive.
Right, okay.
That meant it took a long time to prepare and therefore clearly distinguished yourself from the others. So luxury food was not just imported from abroad, but it took a long time to prepare, involving many layers of food preparation. And the English Tudor bits, the word biscuit, meaning twice baked, is a classic, like the jumbles, which were boiled in water first and then baked in the oven.
Okay, there's something I didn't know. Thank you. Now, popular history would have us believe that when the Tudors sat down to eat, it was a bit chaotic, you know, the chicken legs flying here and there, when in fact there was a very specific set of rules, especially when it came to dining at court. Could you talk to us about Tudor table manners?
Yes, of course. During the 16th century, a growing number of successful middling class merchants were able to purchase luxury food that was generally associated with the nobility, but it was indeed their manners, or as they said then, the courtesy that still defined the true state and therefore set apart from the new world. Now, table manners were seen part of the whole code of Behaviour and Courtesy books specialised on how to eat politely. And that's what it was all about. It was about to eat without making a mess, without spoiling your clothes or the tablecloth dirty underneath. The dining table was also an important to your social hierarchy, and therefore there had to be many rules that pointed out exactly where you had to sit according to your state in society. What many people don't know is everybody had to wash their hands. Now, that was throughout society. Everybody had to wash their hands before they sat down and had their meal.
Yes.
Now, in the upper circles, you had a napkin. And the napkin that you were given, you placed either all over your left shoulder or, less commonly known, over your left wrist.
Okay.
And it basically serves to keep your fingers, but more so your mouth clean.
Mm-hmm.
Because drinking vessels were often shared with others, so you really did not want to have a mouth that was sticky and then
right.
share a vessel with other people. In very wealthy households, that vessel was actually, after somebody had a drink from it, it was taken back, washed, and then it came back to somebody else who called for a drink. The other thing is, a lot of the meals were served on a big platter that was called the mess.
Mm-hmm.
And it was shared a minimum of four people, but sometimes even more. And it was placed in the middle of the table. And then you helped yourself to food, but only to the one that was nearest to you. So it was really bad manners to grab something from the other end of that mess. And you were only allowed to take small portions onto your plate, which was often called the trencher, because you weren't allowed to pick it up with your fingers. And that's where they sometimes had serving forks. They didn't use forks for eating and putting it into your mouth. They used it just purely for serving it from the mess onto your own plate. The same happened very much to pottages, so soups or stews, served in one big bowl, and it was known to be really bad manners to keep your spoon in that bowl when you had enough. Another thing was the voider. There was a plate called the voider, and that was when you put all the food that you no longer wanted to eat because you were full, or any bones that you might have, and that went into the voider, not over your shoulder onto the floor or being fed to the dogs. And that was sometimes then given to the poor or fed to the animals. Also, it was necessary for you to carve any meat on your plate, because most dishes came in bite-sized portions already. But at big feasts, you had a professional carver that would then carve in front of everybody either the swan or any big birds. You had specific terms. You, for instance, it was called to lift a swan or to dismember a heron. And that basically meant that the professional carver did carve that bird how it was meant to be. And there were obviously also books that helped you teach how learn how to do that. Throughout the 16th century, in particular at the end of it, there were definite changes taking place in the dining arrangements. So it was no longer that people sat around a huge table that had more or less the shape of a, but it became that people wanted to eat more in private, in the parlour rather than the hall. And then obviously all the table manners slightly changed and adapted to the new situation.
Wow, such fascinating detail. Thank you so much. Now, if I wanted to cook a meal today and use some of the herb and spices that the Tudors would have commonly used, or maybe even some fruit and vegetables that they would have grown in their kitchen gardens, what sort of things would I cook with?
definitely herbs. Herbs features really throughout the whole of the century. They featured in everybody's cooking, whether at the bottom of society or right at the top of it. But fruit and vegetables were grown in the kitchen gardens.
Mm-hmm.
It obviously depended very much on your son, what you grew, but everybody did grow herbs. And also they were used for culinary as well as medicinal use. And somebody called Thomas Hill published a manual called The Gardener's Labyrinth in 1577, I believe. And he gave you what you should have in your kitchen garden. But typical iconic vegetables in the Tudor period were cabbages. And here in England, we preferred kale, so they called them cucumbers, beans, but only the leaves, not the root, carrots, parsnips, turnips, obviously onion, garlic, leeks, you would have had lettuce, spinach, asparagus, but the wild one you collect from the meadows, artichoke, and specifically for the lower class, you had peas and fava beans, but they were field crops, so you wouldn't grow them in your kitchen garden. They would actually be growing out in the fields. Now, one has to point out that the Indian people were disadvantaged. We did, because of the climate, grow a lot less than, for instance, people in southern Europe would have done. In Italy or Spain, they already had cauliflower, celery, Brussels sprouts, eggplant, kohlrabi, you name it. We did not. Mm. Not even squashy tomatoes or potatoes, peppers featured. They were introduced to Europe, but here in England, we only knew about them, but we didn't taste them at all. But fruit was another very common thing that people grew in their orchards if they had the room for it. Apples, obviously, crab apples were very important to produce something called verjuice, which was the vinegar of the day in England. Pears, plums, cherries, Anne Boleyn's favorite, apparently. Medlars, quinces, strawberries, gooseberries, barberries, you name it. Again, all the fruit that was introduced a royal member of the family, we know exactly when it first came to England, such as the apricots. We know that is 1548 because Henry's gardener, Wolfe, recorded it as specifically having been imported from France to go into his Henry's garden at Nonsuch. The same for the gooseberries. We know that in 1516, Henry had organized for gooseberry bushes to be imported from Germany into his garden. Fruit was very much encouraged to be eaten raw because to the Tudors, it was seen as a kind of problematic because it was considered cold and wet, and in our climate that was cool and damp, that meant the fruit wasn't easy to digest, and the only way around it was actually cook it. But we also know that, for instance, Robert Dudley, again our trendsetter when it comes to food, he did order a lot of fruit. He spent a fortune on fruit. Fruit was expensive, and we know from his records that he constantly spent lots of money on quinces, pomegranate, and also foreign imported fruit like the Genoa plums. And funny enough, Elizabeth, while she was living, the accounts that she spent a staggering £119 in 1 year on just fruit,
wow,
which was, I think, 1551 to 1502. So we know exactly what royalty, what kind of fruit and vegetables they had. But it also meant that it was grown in the orchards of farmers.
Wow, what amazing detail. Thank you so much. It's so fascinating and really brings them to life, I think. Now, you mentioned that sometimes ordinary people didn't have a kitchen in which to cook, so they, you know, they'd purchase, sort of get takeaway, I suppose. Would they have eaten any meat? So they obviously would have grown herbs and things. Would they have had any meat in their diet?
Yes, they would have had a meat, most likely bacon.
Right,
so
okay.
the less expensive parts of the pig. Also offal. Offal was considered the meat of the poor. Funny enough, that actually became very trendy towards the late 16th century, and then later reverted back to the meat of the poor.
Right.
But they would have mostly used it in pottages, so in stews and thick soups, not roasted and not baked. That was the main difference. They did have access to meat, but it was the cheap type of meat, mm-hmm. and it was the way how they prepared it, basically.
Right, okay, I see. Now, I know you have a great love of Tudor food, and you're trying to do everything you can to promote it, which is wonderful. What are some of your favourite Tudor dishes to make?
That's a very good question. I think the challenge for me is to try out new recipes,
right.
Because you can never predict what it's going to taste like.
Mm.
But personally, I like the vegetarian recipes, which generally feature for the fish days when meat wasn't allowed to be eaten, which was Wednesdays, Fridays and Saturdays. And here in particular, I like the herb and vegetable tart and pottages. And I also like cooking seasonal food. So, for instance, at Christmas, I like preparing the Christmas 12th night cake. The Simmelt cake at Easter, and now pancakes for coming up Tuesday, Shrove Tuesday. And today, being Valentine's Day, I made buckets for my husband because we've been married 30 years, so I thought it had to be something
lovely.
But also Sunday roast, yes. So it varies. I don't have one particular one that I like best. It's a whole range depending on what the occasion is and what the season is.
Okay, wonderful. Now, we're going to change topics slightly here. I'd love to know what a kind of day in the life of a Tudor farmer and his family may have been like. Like, what were the routines, the meals or the pastimes? Can you give us a bit of a summary about that?
Right, okay. Now, there are two types of farmers.
Right.
There is the yeoman that who made his living in rural areas, and he basically legally was termed the 40 shilling freeholder. Mm. Now, yeomans often were very successful businessmen who were really well off and could afford to employ staff to do the work on the land for them. And they very often saw themselves as gentleman farmers and part of the life of gentlemen. So they didn't do any work themselves, which is quite interesting.
Mm.
And then you had the husbandmen.
Right.
They were typically small-scale tenant farmers, and they were considered to be part of the lowest level of society. Now, they often also carried out work on other farms. I am currently actually researching the case of yeoman farmers. There are two in particular, Henry Best and William Honeywell, and it's fascinating to see what they did to make themselves appear better in society. But the day of a husbandman was a very long one. They got up very, very early. Before dawn, they had to tend to the animals, feed them, milk them. The wife would start the fire and the cooking process.
Mm-hmm.
And only after about 2 hours' work, a simple breakfast was then served, which would be bread and small ale. And depending on the season, the farmer would then spend the day out on the field working, sowing, ploughing, harvesting, and would only really return just before dusk.
Right.
When he was given a late simple meal. In winter, it was a little bit different. Winter was the season when repair work was carried out and when the farmer would look for new livestock, such as pigs and sheep. The wife, her responsibility was preserving the food, making simple clothes, mending mm-hmm. them, making cheese, making bread, even spinning the wool, preparing rush sides. She was also responsible for the kitchen garden and the herb garden, so to care for the children and the sick and elderly. Now, as one can imagine, there was little free time, but it was Sunday afternoon and holidays, so religious holidays, that gave them an opportunity to enjoy themselves, and that's when then dancing and singing would take place. They would play board games such as chess or nine men's morris or tables, as it was known, which is today's backgammon, and also outdoor games like skittles or a very rough version of football if the weather allowed. And they also did outdoor activities. Some were more given by law, like archery. Every man between 6 and 60 had to practice his archery skills on a Sunday afternoon. So, yes, there was a little bit of free time, but it was mostly work associated and a very hard, tough life.
Yes, definitely. It sounds like that. Now, you mentioned that it was the wife's job to tend to the family and the children and also to look after the elderly and anyone that became sick. What remedies would the Tudor housewife have used to treat common ailments like headaches or tummy aches, that sort of thing?
Right. Okay. That in itself is actually a huge, huge topic.
Okay, yes.
We could go on talking about it for, hours. But what was significant was that in order to treat the family for those ailments, the hair with how the body worked, and that in those days was the humoral system, where we know the body was made up of four humours: the blood, the phlegm, the yellow and the black bile, and every person was then also ascribed four temperaments, which was melancholic, choleric, phlegmatic, or sanguine. Mm-hmm. And the housewife had to know that. She had to be able to assess every family member on in what group they fell, and then find the balance by means of quren, because every food had also got a character ascribed to it. So she knew which herbs, which food would help any ailment. She also, there were actually some, usually it was, that knowledge was passed on from mother to daughter, but if that wasn't a possibility, there were books that helped. For instance, in 1564, astrologer Philip Moore, he produced a small, rather inexpensive book that did tell people on how to help sick people. Now, for headache, what the housewife did, she prepared either flavored waters or she prepared ointments using herbs. And for headaches, what they often used was basil, crushed leaves, as used as a snuff, or the juice of the white beet. A herb called betony, crushed cherries was another one. It was meant to relieve migraines. Mm-hmm. Pink, the flower, cowslip, the flower, or even poppy seeds or rue. Now, with rue, you have to know that it also is poisonous.
That's right.
So yeah. It's like today's medication, a little bit too much. Mm. You actually did more harm than good. But for tummy ache, there were loads of herbs. To just mention a few, there was clover, there was comfrey, cornflower, dill, fennel. Now, dill and fennel we still use, don't we, in gripe water for babies.
That's right.
But also fig, ginger, ginger is another one we still use, don't we? Mm-hmm. Juniper, berries, mint, ash leaves. It really depended on what caused the tamiate, whether it was associated with a young woman getting their first periods, or whether it was or constipation or diarrhea. It did depend on what it exactly was that they then treated it. And as I said, the housewife, her prime job was to harvest the herbs and to prepare them into, well, sort of medicines, and to preserve them for the winter months as well.
Okay, wonderful. I'm always amazed at how multi-skilled, how they were able to multi-skill and the knowledge that they had. That's quite amazing. Now, I know that you're also very interested in antique furniture. So what kind of furniture would we have commonly found in the home? Let's just say an ordinary Tudor family.
Yes. Well, in an ordinary family's house, there would have been actually very little and very few items. We would be amazed how bare it would have actually looked. But and we do know that furniture was one of the most prized possessions and therefore always featured in wills. That's why we know what sort of furniture they had. We remember Shakespeare, for instance, leaving his second best bed to his wife. But the middling suite had trunks, often referred to as coffers or chests, for keeping their few belongings and blankets. They had very simple bedsteads, stools, no chairs. Chairs were definitely something we only for the wealthy, hence the term chairman.
Ah, I see.
Horns, okay. Which was the Tudor term for benches.
Mm-hmm.
Trestle tables. What's significant is that most furniture was also collapsible and portable, which is quite interesting. But chairs, cupboards and aubries, these are food cupboards, were extremely expensive, and only the rich would have had those.
Yeah, goodness. Yeah, that's another topic that I think we could talk about for about an hour, just on the or more, just about the furniture. Now, Brigitte.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. I've become a little bit obsessed lately with Tudor household and etiquette and recipe books. I'm always searching on the internet trying to find a new one to acquire. Now, what are some of your favourite books of the time?
Oh, right. Very difficult choice to make. I like them all. But I think if I have to narrow them down, my one is called A Proper New Book of Cookery, which was published in 1557. And the only copy of this particular print belongs to Matthew Parker. Now, he was the 14th master of the Corpus Christi College in Cambridge, and he also was Archbishop of Canterbury between 1559 and 1575. And we know quite a lot about this particular one because it was used by his wife Margaret, and there is quite a lot of documents that describe Margaret's and Matthew's social events. But I also like The Good Housewife's Jewel, published in 1596 by Thomas Dawson, which reflects the period slightly later towards the end of the Tudor period, with all the new trends coming in. And thirdly, I personally love a work called The Opera by Bartolomeo Scappi, published in 1570. And as the name says, he was Italian. He actually was a chef to several popes. But what's significant about that book is it's the first modern with detailed recipes. It gives also shopping advice, full menus and illustrations, and that makes it very special to me too.
Gosh, they all sound fascinating. I had heard of the first two that you mentioned, but not the last one, so I'm going to have to go and do a bit of research on that one. Thank you. Now, Brigitte, during your extensive research into the Tudor court, have you discovered anything, or did you discover anything that really kind of surprised you or that gave you a good giggle?
Right. Well, most of my in-depth research focuses mostly on food and plants, and it never fails to surprise me how many things we still do today out of habit, but no longer seem to know why. Now, I always get very excited when, as part of my research, I come across the answer to such habit.
Right.
And it was just last week that I discovered why we use wine with venison or dark meat.
Right.
And the origins of this actually lies in the medieval humoral belief that the warming characteristic of the red wine helped to correct those of venison. And it's a physician called Tobias Venner who goes into detail about that, how it worked and why you had to have red wine and not white wine with venison. And I thought, wow, yes. But also stuff related to furniture. For instance, the term exchequer comes from the counting table that had a checkered top, which is a typical late medieval 16th century item of furniture.
Yeah, I absolutely love coming across things like that. Thank you. I didn't know about the red wine. That's so interesting. Fascinating stuff. Now, we are actually coming to the end of our conversation. I could chat with you all day. You're absolutely unbelievably knowledgeable. Thank you for sharing that with us. Now, it's actually time to play our little game of 10 to go. So these are just 10 quick questions for you. Are you ready?
I hope so.
Okay, number one, what inspires you or how do you find inspiration?
I love reading books about the pet, and it's often a detail that I come across that inspires me to do more research. But it's also museums, and you see an item that makes you think, oh, I wonder how that worked. Yes, so it's materials and books.
All right, fabulous. Yeah, I completely agree with you. Number two, when you were a child, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Well, I can't remember. There were so many different things. It changed all the time. But I do remember I wanted to be a boy.
Okay. All right, thank you.
I wanted to be a man because you had so many more choices.
Right, okay, yeah, I understand. Okay, number three, what was the last movie you watched?
The last movie I watched was The Favourite.
Oh, okay, lovely. I haven't seen that one yet. All right, number four, if you had a time machine, let's just pretend that you could travel back to witness one event or one moment in Tudor history, what would it be for you?
I think it would have to be the Field of Gold, in 1520.
Oh, I think I'm joining you there. That's an event I would have absolutely loved to have seen. All right, number five, what's something you love about where you live?
I think it's because we are surrounded by buildings that date to the 16th century and earlier. Lots to check out.
That's fabulous. Now, I know it's not good to be jealous, but I'm a little bit jealous of you right now, how I'd love to be surrounded by Tudor buildings. All right. Number six, if you were forced to flee Earth, I don't know why, but if you were forced to flee Earth and you could only take one book with you, what would it be?
I think it would be John Jarrett's Great Herbal from 1597. Even though quite a bit of fibbing, to me still, it's one of my all-time favourites, yeah.
All right, thank you. Number seven, if you could swap places with one person, they whether they're living or dead, for a day, who would it be?
I would go with Bess of Hardwick.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good one. I like that one.
She is my ideal lady.
Yeah, definitely a remarkable woman, no doubt. Number eight, what was the last thing you bought?
A book. A book on cookery and food between 1500 and 1640.
Oh, that sounds good. What's that book
There's
called?
There's no great surprise there.
No, I know.
Good question. It does not have a very inspiring title. It's called The Food and Identity in England, 1540 to 1640.
Okay, well, it's a straightforward title, isn't it? All right. I think... Oh, no, we've got two more questions to go.
No hiding there.
No hiding, exactly. Number 9, what does your morning routine look like?
It's getting up and making a healthy breakfast for my husband. If my daughter is at home, my daughter too. Yes, healthy breakfast, start the day.
Yeah, lovely. That's a good way to start. And lucky last, one more question. What would you like to see more of in the world?
Communication. Mm. People talking to each other and not assuming they know what people are all about.
Yeah, I think that's a very good thing. And we have come to the end. It's time for your Tudor takeaway. Do you have something for us to go off and explore after this episode?
Yes, definitely. I think for people interested in what farm life was all about,
yes,
in Tudor times, I can recommend Ruth Goodman's Monastic Tudor Farm DVD. It's a few years old now, but the facts are still there, and it's one of the most inspiring and interesting productions I have come across. If you want to get more into Tudor cookery and you're after recipes without having to invest in books, mm-hmm. because they sometimes can be very difficult to understand, and you can follow my Facebook page where I constantly update the recipes about, and they're usually easy to follow.
Oh, fabulous. They're both wonderful. I know the DVDs are fantastic. I love those DVDs. And definitely following your Facebook page is something I hope everyone does. And I'll add a link to the page from the show notes just to make it nice and easy for everyone. And we've come to the end. Thank you so much for talking to me today so early in the morning as well. And it's been really wonderful.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I thoroughly enjoyed talking to you. As I said, it's one of my passion is cookery, Tudor cookery, and I want it for the world to see, come on, this is really cool.
I love it. All right, everyone, let's get Tudor cooking, I think. All right, thank you so much. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tudors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website, www.onthetudortrail.com, where you'll also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tudors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.